have Dr. Michael Sari sitting in the wings, waiting to give us the latest on the pandemic. So let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Sari. We're very lucky to have him as a member of our club. He's very esteemed in his medical community. He's a ham, Kilo Alpha 3 India X-ray Oscar, and he is an infectious diseases specialist in Rockville and is affiliated with Shady Grove and Suburban Hospital. Dr. Sari graduated from Loyola University Chicago Stritch School of Medicine and completed his residencies and infectious diseases fellowship in the military. Dr. Sari specializes in internal medicine and occupational medicine and is a clinical professor at Johns Hopkins and the Uniformed Services University of Health Services right here in Bethesda. So within our amateur radio community, Dr. Sari has been the, quote, top doc shadow for the last 10 years at the annual Marine Corps Marathon. He is also the communication officer for a Civil Air Patrol squadron in Gaithersburg and an IC communication unit leader for the Maryland Wing. He is also the Civil Air Patrol Mid-Atlantic Region, that's 7 states, Health Services Officer. So quite impressive, and we are indeed very lucky and very grateful to have him here tonight. So I'm just going to hand it. Dr. Sari is going to do a presentation, and then he's going to take questions and answers. So I'm just going to hand over control to Dr. Sari. So this is W3JAG, and I'm going to hand over to Kilo Alpha 3 India X-ray Oscar Duff. It's all yours.
This is K3IX, so thank you, Alex, for arranging this. And I'm going to try, so I don't get timed out too much, to sort of break it up into a discussion of the history, the agent, the current pandemic, the epidemiology, signs and symptoms, high-risk population, the tests we have available, treatment options, and a plan to return back to normal, or normalcy, if there's such a thing. In between these, I'd like to open it up for any questions.
Whiskey Bravo, 2 Uniforms.
I think the best way to start a discussion on this particular virus is that it's not the first time it's shown up in the world. This is actually the third pandemic. We had SARS back in 2003 and 4, and MERS in Saudi Arabia in 2014. And those particular coronaviruses, which are very similar to this one, were a lot more lethal. And they primarily killed healthcare workers. That was the characteristic of those pandemics, a lot like Ebola. So, again, this is just another of the many pandemics and emerging diseases that we've had to deal with over the decades. SARS in 2004, avian 2008, swine flu 2010, MERS again in 12, Ebola in 14, Zika in 16, and now we got coronavirus. So these are occurring a little more frequently, and there's a lot to the discussion on emerging diseases is another lecture altogether. The virus actually is very similar to the Spanish flu, H1N1 and Ebola and hepatitis C and several other viruses. So we pretty much have a pretty good idea of this virus. It isn't our, as ID docs, it isn't our first rodeo with this particular agent. We kind of know what to expect from it. I think the best that I can tell you is that we are currently experiencing the Spanish flu of 1918. The only difference between the Spanish flu and this particular virus is technology. If we didn't have the technology we had today, the death rates would be phenomenal. If we didn't have conditioned air and good housing and all kinds of modern conveniences and protection, and our health of our population wasn't as good, we'd be in a world of hurt. Is there any particular questions at this point?
Yeah, I do have a question, but I'm spinning it off your PowerPoint. Over.
So I'm not going to be specifically following the PowerPoint. I think that it was actually for biosafety officers, about 4,000 of them around the world that I was giving the talk to. And I think that though there's some information I will discuss, I think like any evolving disease and pandemic, things are changing pretty rapidly.
Okay, I just had some questions about some terminology, nomenclature. I'll leave it to the end when you field some QA later on. Thanks, WBTO.
Roger that. The current pandemic, if you look at epidemic curves, really shows that we're now in the logarithmic phase of the epidemic. I think actually the administration did give us about 4 months of time for the scientific community to start developing vaccines and antivirals and diagnostic kits and tests that we didn't have for whatever reason. And I think that that was helpful, but holding back the virus is only temporary, and it is now throughout the world in a logarithmic phase, as you can see in Italy, and France, and Spain, and Iran, and other countries like that. Because of the fact that this is going so rapidly, you've heard of models, and the Gates Foundation probably had the best modeling of what to expect with this disease, and they were literally expecting at this point in time 81,000 deaths, and currently we have 26,000 deaths in the United States and about 641 cases. The world actually has 2 million cases and 134,000 deaths. Though it looks and acts a lot like flu initially, its mortality rate is about 20 times that of flu. So it is a very lethal virus and something to be obviously respected. We have tried to develop mitigation measures based on what we felt would be the most likely transmission routes. We know flu and most respiratory diseases and coronavirus. Some of the coronavirus has actually caused common cold in humans, but they're not this particular type of coronavirus, which is a lot more lethal. And so these are primarily transmitted by droplets, and I know it's confusing because people say, oh, it can be aerosolized. Well, we can aerosolize just about any pathogen, including salmonella, but the reality is, what's the likelihood that I'm going to get salmonella in the air rather than eating it in bad food? And that's really where we're coming from with this particular agent. We know that it's transmitted by droplets, that the droplets usually only go 3 to 6 feet, and they stay on surfaces for probably about 4 hours, though you've heard people say 9 days and things like that. It doesn't tolerate desiccation or dryness or heat very well, definitely not the sun. And so generally it has a limited survival outside of the host. But in areas where there's lots of people and people are touching common surfaces like rails and door knobs and things like that, this particular disease can be transmitted from person to person. Generally, what the virus wants is to get into your mouth, your nose, or your eyes, and that's where you have to continually disinfect those common touch areas and wash your hands frequently. I think that is probably the most important mitigation measure. People talk about masks, but the reality is that if you stay 6 feet away from people, you're not likely to get anything from them. The purpose of a mask, especially the cloth mask, is what we call source control. It's trying to prevent the person who's sick from giving it to you. It's not actually going to protect you from a close contact with a patient who has this disease. So the mitigation measures are primarily to what they call flatten the curve. And what they're really trying to do is to reduce the number of cases below the healthcare surge capacity. We actually don't have much surge capacity in our healthcare system. In order for us to get more capacity, we have to kick patients out, stop all elective surgery, move patients out to nursing homes or other places, and that's how we get our surge capacity. And when we overrun that, then we're the government is left to building these massive temporary hospitals or bring in hospital ships. I'll just break here for now if there's any questions about what I've just said. Well, and I'll go on to signs and symptoms. Generally, this is a respiratory disease that primarily presents as fever, cough, and a shortness of breath, though about a quarter of the people get a diarrhea from it. And though they have seen viruses in the stool, they don't believe that it's really transmitted that way, or at least not very effectively, especially with our standard of hygiene that we have in the U.S. But this disease usually will progress to the point where you become symptomatic within 5 days of the exposure. And then at that point, you might start to be really feeling short of breath with fever, and at that point, you really need to report to a hospital to have an evaluation. The reality is that 80% of the people that get this disease have no symptoms, or they have very mild symptoms. These are people who are usually less than 50 years of age. The other 20% are usually older. They have a lot of what we call comorbidities, like heart disease, emphysema, uncontrolled diabetes, or they're immunosuppressed with some agent, whether it's for cancer or for autoimmune disorders like Crohn's disease or rheumatoid arthritis, and they're the ones that don't tend to do well. But even of that 20%, about 75% of them, 15% of them, really all they need is a little supplemental oxygen. That's the only reason they're coming into the hospital. The other 5% are severely ill. They actually need ventilatory support, and unfortunately, their mortality rate is close to or over 50%. And again, this is mainly where all of our deaths are coming from. It's not from the young population. Though the young population may actually be spreading the disease through the community, it is actually the old and infirm that are at risk. So in many ways, the mitigation measures are designed to try to protect that population, which is oftentimes in nursing homes, to protect them from the general population. And unfortunately, as you've seen in Maryland and Virginia, we've had some significant epidemics occurring inside some of these nursing homes, and that's how it initially started in the state of Washington. So these are primarily the symptoms that you should be on the lookout for, and that's the high-risk population that we're worried the most about. KA3IXO.
You can go ahead, Michael. I thought I disabled the timeout timer, but you were doing great until that, and we really didn't miss a syllable even. It was perfect timing that you unkeyed as it was timing out.
Roger that. So now I'd like to talk about the tests. You've heard about the nasopharyngeal PCR test that actually looks for the presence of virus in the body, in the nose. and you've heard about this, these new immunologic tests that they're hoping will be the solution for us able to get back to some normalcy by being able to tell us, are we immune, are we susceptible? And I think that these are tests that unfortunately have not been available as much as they should have been. And there's lots of reasons for that. The primary problem was the manufacturer had bad primers for the PCR. And actually China had the same kind of problem. The ones they donated to Belgium and Spain and UK were actually sent back because they weren't working well. So there are some technical problems with the PCR. When they talk about the PCR, they talk about it as the rapid test, but the reality is that that PCR actually has to be sent, the swab has to be sent to a major CLIA-certified lab, and the delay in getting it done is usually transportation. The test takes about 4 hours to do. There is a new test, a new PCR that they've talked about, the Abbott test, and it's supposed to be a point-of-service test where you do it right there, you get the answer within 4 hours, but it has to be done in a hospital or which has a major certified lab. So it's not the type of test where in my clinic I would do a quick strep or a quick flu or a pregnancy test and get the answer right away. That's not the type of test this PCR is. And it's only primarily designed for diagnosis of ill patients. It's not actually used to be a screening test. So the one that is a screening test and is a point of service test and can give you a result within 10 minutes is the immunological test. And that's looking for the presence of antibodies for this particular virus. And it tells us whether or not you're susceptible, whether you have an infection, or whether or not you've gotten through the infection and now you're immune and you can't get the disease again and you can't give it to anybody else. Because that's how coronavirus works. Once you get the disease, you have immunity to when the vaccine is available in about a year. So it's very hopeful. I've been treating some of my patients with the hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, and they've been doing quite well. They get better very quickly. So you might be able to take chloroquine just like you would take it for malaria and prophylaxis, and you might be able to not have to worry when you leave the house and go back to work about getting this particular infection. But again, I think that's going to take another month or two to work out. So a lot of the return to normalcy is our ability to return back to work. And let me just stop there and see if there's any questions on treatment. Under that. Thank you, Fred. So going back to the treatment, so we've talked about some of the testing that we can use. The treatment currently, the mainstay is supportive care. In other words, we're just giving supplemental oxygen to those 15% of people that enter the hospital. The other 5% of the 20 that enter the hospital are getting needing ventilatory support. We have about a dozen antiviral therapeutics that we have been working with, both in China and Europe and the U.S., and they're looking very promising. And I've been using hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin for my patients who are moderately ill, and they've been able to stay out of the hospital and get better. But I think what's more important is that some of these antivirals may actually be used as a prophylaxis. So we might be able to use chloroquine almost like we use it for malaria, taking it daily so that we don't get COVID and we're able to go back to work. So obviously the final solution to this particular pandemic is a vaccine, but that's going to take about a year to develop, and most vaccines take about 8 to 10 years to develop. And so in order for us to get to that point, I think by having good diagnostic tests that will tell us if we're immune and safe to go back to work and not worry about getting the disease because we already got it, or we have a good prophylactic agent to take, or we have maybe just a good antiviral that we can take if we start to get the disease. A lot like Tamiflu with influenza. You get the flu, you didn't get, whether you got the flu shot or not, we can give you some Tamiflu that makes you feel better, quickly. Any questions at this point about therapeutics?
WB to you.
W1 on Y.
K3ISO.
Hi, Dr. Sorry, I think Vic, WBTU, had a question for you. It's W3JAG.
You copy me okay, Doc?
Yes, I did. I thought I had just broken up. Go ahead, Vic, with your question.
Yeah, Roger. The notion of prophylactic, and you can go back to work kind of a deal, but you're not immune. The prophylactic just prevents you from for this virus settling into your system. But ultimately, aren't you still, I mean, it's not like you're immune or anything, so I'm wondering if you still have to take other precautions in order not to catch the virus. So I don't know if that makes, if that's a clear question or not. Back to you, Doc. This is WB2U.
WB2U, K3IXO. I think that's a good point, and I try to emphasize the fact that a prophylaxis is only a bridge. We're really trying to figure out how do we keep people who are high risk safe until we have the vaccine that will make them safe. And I think that obviously we don't want to give you a false sense of security by giving you a mask and not telling you to wash your hands regularly, or giving you a prophylaxis and say go ahead and get all the mosquito bites that you want in a malarious area. So I think that we still want you to do what you what is reasonable, keeping a certain distance, and certainly we would want you to stay away from other high-risk people. I don't know if that answers your question, Vic.
Yes, it does. Thanks. WB to you.
Any other questions?
W1RNY, Andrew.
W1RY, K3IXO.
There are a couple different questions that I have for you. One, these tests were kind of rushed. I mean, how do we know what the true sensitivities are, that the false positive negative rates, you know, are not unacceptable? That's one question. The other one, the studies that I read about chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine are not clear. They're not clear to me that they're efficacious. And, you know, you said that you've had patients that have gotten better since, and hasn't been fully double-blinded. How do you know they might not have gotten better anyway? And how do we really know for sure that this is going to act, you know, in a prophylactic way to prevent the illness? And the third question I have for you is, do you have any information about the potential use of alpha interferon in, you know, in treating this?
Well, I think those are all very good questions. And I think that starting off with the tests and how good are they, I think that all we pretty much know about these tests are that we've known the platforms, like PCR and the immunological tests, for the longest time. And so we know their weaknesses and their strengths. Generally, a PCR has a very high sensitivity, so it's likely to be able to tell you, to give you a true positive. If the person has a disease, it's going to pick it up. On the other hand, the immunological tests have a high specificity. They're more than likely going to rule out a person who doesn't have a disease. And so we know that that's their strength. But when you, it's also important how you apply the test. If you're applying the test to a population that has very little of the disease, you're not going to get a very efficient test. There's going to be a lot of, the predictive value of that positive or negative test are fairly low. But if you apply it to people who are very sick with the disease, it's likely that's the best performance you'll see in those tests. With respect to COVID, we don't know how these tests are going to perform, but we do have an idea from MERS and from SARS that it's likely to be pretty to function pretty good. There is going to be false negatives, false positives, and we're currently actually using that. One of my clients in the Gulf Coast petrochemical company is using these tests, and we've been doing internal validity tests because, frankly, you're right. It's the Wild West out there. When you have emergency utilization authorization from FDA that allows companies to hawk their test without proving that they have a great test, you really have to have a little skepticism. But again, and it requires us to do that extra validity testing. With respect to chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, we know that it's, I used it back in the 80s for mononucleosis because it did, it was a good immune modulator. It does inhibit, we know, the COVID primarily by interrupting its viral assembly. What we try to do with some of these drugs is try to interrupt the overreaction that occurs when people have this infection. We call that a cytokine storm. And so some of these agents, like the Actemra, which we use for rheumatoid arthritis, is a monoclonal antibody that actually interrupts interleukin-6 and prevents the cytokine storm. We also use interferon with ribavirin for many diseases like hepatitis C, and it actually is one of those agents that we're studying.
Many years ago, I kind of serendipitously fell into using interferon. I have polycythemia vera. The day I got to medical school, I discovered that. And while I was using it, I found out that it would, you know, it would help prevent a flu, or if I were getting symptoms, I would take it and I would get better. That was back, I guess, in the 80s and 90s. And then, you know, not long ago, I've seen research that suggests that interferon alpha can be used, you know, to prevent, you know, potentially prevent the flu, and it may work with coronavirus. I from what I understand, countries all over the world are hitting on Cuba to provide it. They've been making interferon for about 35 years, as I understand it.
W1RY, this is K3IX. So you're absolutely right, and it is being studied, and it has been studied in hepatitis C and also with respiratory or syncytial virus. I have to say that you hear a lot about the failed Ebola drug, remdesivir, about some of these HIV drugs, Caltrate, and an experimental Japanese protease inhibitor that they've been touting as an influenza drug, favipravir. And all of this data is actually based on only the thinnest threads of in vitro evidence. Some animal models, maybe just biological plausibility. I mean, we have to be very cautious about it. And even chloroquine, hydrochloroquine that everybody's excited about, it can't actually be given to people who have heart disease. So we have to be, that's why we're doing all these clinical trials. And I know everybody wants it today. They don't want to do the trials. They say people are dying right and left. But we have actually killed a lot of people with chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine in other countries, and they've had to stop the trials because of that.
Well, thank you for that. This is W1RNY.
I'm sorry, I got you. WR1Y. This is K3IXO. Any other questions?
W3MGZ.
I missed your call sign, but go ahead with your question.
Hi, good evening. This is Whiskey 3, Michael Zulu. The name is Smart. One of my first questions is, with the advent now of new testing, I know that we've been using nasopharyngeal swabs, and now I think they're coming up with the sputum sample tests. Is there any advantage, or should I say, is it more reliable than the nasopharyngeal swab, or if so, the nasopharyngeal swab is still the standard for testing? And then the next, I think you mentioned it already with regards to the use of chloroquine. If I was going to ask if you've seen any progress or very promising results with cardiac patients, because I know the effects with the ARBs that they're taking, and you just answered it that you don't give it to patients with cardiac problems. Then the third question is there any role? I know you're talking about prophylaxis, but in terms of prevention, is there any real use into these? Is there a role for the taking of, let's say, melatonin, zinc, and vitamin D, and all these other supplements just to have prevention? Is there any use for this, or it's just to make people feel safe about that? W3MG, then.
Hey, Mark, you have some great questions there. Let's start off with the nasopharyngeal swab versus the oral pharyngeal or oral swab. The studies have shown that the oral swab doesn't perform as well as the nasopharyngeal. And at the same time, both of them differ depending on the stage of the disease. Early on, the virus is in the nose and the posterior pharynx. But if you start to, if you get somebody who's had the disease for about 7 or more days, you won't find it there. Your test will be negative, and the only way you'll find it is by going into the lungs with a bronchial alveolar lavage. There you'll pick it up. So a lot of the problems with some of the false negatives with PCR is at the stage of when you're trying to pick it up. So the later on in the disease, the less likely you'll pick it up. From the standpoint of chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, the biggest problem is a prolonged QT interval on electrocardiogram. It can cause a torsade, a fatal arrhythmia. And unfortunately, both azithromycin and hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine can prolong the QT interval. And so that's the reason why we have to be very careful. And I usually will do an EKG on the individual before I give it to them. From the standpoint of certain supplements, I don't know, I haven't heard melatonin to be helpful, but I have heard that there's a study where they're adding zinc to hydroxychloroquine because they feel that that helps drive the hydroxychloroquine better into the cell. I'm not sure I got all your answers, but did I miss one, Mark?
So you answered everything. Thank you very much. It's just that the reason why I included melatonin there, because there were studies, especially with some of my colleagues before, who's in New Jersey, that they are including melatonin now for patients, especially in New York, I think, because they've noticed that one of the factors or one of the things which differentiates adults from pediatric patients is that, and the pediatric population is not really getting it, but it's rare, more in the pediatric population. It's because of the melatonin levels of children as compared to adults. So that's why they were recommending about 75 to 100 milligrams of melatonin for these patients who are already infected, I think, with the COVID-19. So anyway, that's why I wanted to ask if there's any role for melatonin also included in the prophylaxis of these patients. Thank you very much, 73, W3MGZ.
Okay, 3IXO. I think that what you're alluding to is what we're looking for is common denominators that we can sort of use that might give us some clues or insight into treatment. I think one of the most interesting treatments is the use of an angiotensin receptor blocker, losartan. A lot of us are taking losartan or olmesartan for hypertension, and what they are, it's a blocker, but what it's blocking is actually something called the angiotensin receptor. Well, it turns out that the angiotensin receptor is the target for COVID in the lungs. So if you take INT hypertensive, you might actually block the virus from getting to the receptor. So that's one of the fascinating studies that is being done right now therapeutically.
Thank you very much for clarifying that, and I appreciate it. W3MD says.
K3IXO, any other questions?
3 Foxtrot Gene, over.
Yes, Gene.
How similar to the 1918 Spanish flu is the current virus? You had alluded to that very early on in your presentation this evening. And I kind of picked up on that. Two reasons. Number one, the tradition we have in our family, or the rumor we have in our family, is that my father's father died of the Spanish flu in 1920. I guess he acquired it late on in the cycle. But more recently, I heard this morning on the Today Show, Dr. Fauci saying that he was asked by one of the anchors on the Today Show, what is the likelihood of someone having a relapse of the Corona 19 virus, COVID 19, after they had recovered from it? And he said that we don't know very much about subsequent susceptibility. They don't know whether having had the antibodies in your body from recovering from one bout with the virus, whether those antibodies would protect for a month, for 3 months, 6 months, a year, etc. Are the two viruses, the COVID-19 and the Spanish flu from 100 years ago, similar enough that we ought to be able to make some type of inference regarding the immune benefits of having gone through and survived the current virus? Over.
Gene, that's a great question. I didn't want to mislead people by saying that this was a flu or H1N1, which is what the Spanish flu was. What I wanted to say was that this is as bad as the Spanish flu. The Spanish flu killed 50 to 100 million people. That was 1% of the population in the world. That was the first time the world actually lost population. And it was 180 times more lethal than our seasonal flu. And I mentioned to you that this one is like 20 times more lethal. And it generally, it affected about 25 to 30% of the world back in 1918. And its mortality rate was about the same, 2 to 4%, as this particular COVID. So in many ways, it is as lethal. Definitely one that hasn't stopped yet and is going through other countries now that had essentially enjoyed either a seasonal pause from it in the tropics or whatever, but it is now going through their populations. Flattening the curves that we wanted to do may simply be making the hill a plateau because it's running through the different cities trying to get after all of the susceptibles. But it is possible that this disease may essentially end up infecting 25 to 30% of our population, just like the Spanish flu did. But like the Spanish flu, if we get this disease, we're going to be immune to it. Now, you're right. We don't know the length of the time of full immunity. But oftentimes, even with influenza, there's partial immunity. So that if we get it again 2, 3, 4 years later, we'll only get a mild case of the disease. Gene, did that answer your question, K3IXO?
Yeah, it did. Excuse me, Michael. I appreciate your clarifying the comment comparing the two outbreaks. I guess it's kind of encouraging to hear that if you survive the current outbreak, there's some amount of immunity for some limited amount of time, so it might keep you from getting it a second time in the current season. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it. This is AD3F FlugClear.
So one of the things we don't know about this particular COVID, is it going to be like flu that mutates every year a little bit and causes us to have to change the vaccine on a yearly basis? I think that most of the experts feel that there may be a little bit of a pause in the summer because this virus does not like the sun. It doesn't like heat. And the amount of community spread usually decreases with MERS and SARS and summertime. But Bob Redfield, who I did my ID fellowship with at Walter Reed, he's now director of CDC, he feels that this is going to come back in the fall. And I think that that's why we have to have a game plan, a long-term game plan like a vaccine to deal with this particular virus. And Spanish flu actually came several years it wasn't just 1918. It went for a couple of more years and knocked off a couple of more tens of thousands of people. So this one may be one that we just need that vaccine to protect against these recurrences.
Okay, your comment about the temperature being unfriendly to the current virus kind of reminds me of Andromeda Strain, if anybody's ever read that book. Fascinating novel. So thanks again for your clarification, Doctor. Appreciate it. This is AD3F Clear.
So before I go into another last topic, I wanted just to say that this virus is very easy to kill. I mean, a lot of people think that, you know, there's no way to get it off surfaces, but if you take a tenth of a solution of regular household bleach, that's 0.5%, regular bleach is 5%, and you put it on the surface with COVID, it'll kill it in a minute, and alcohol will do the same. So I think that you need to recognize that washing your hands, disinfecting surfaces is a very effective mitigation effort. Any questions about disinfection? Because that's always a controversy.
I do have a question about temperature.
W3BTU, KA3IXO. Go ahead, Vic.
This is a real naive question, I'm sure. We all have a body temperature of approximately 98.6. Some of us are cooler, but we also get fevers. Why doesn't our temperature kind of kill the virus? And this thing about what Eugene just said about, or Gene said about temperature. I remember that movie, and I think pH or something like that, the amount of alkaline or acidity, I guess, in our blood, brings me to my next question. I hear that O-type blood is a little bit more resistant to it. So basically, two questions there: one on temperature, and one on type of blood. Over.
Well, K3IX. So, Vic, I've never seen where the type of blood is, and type O is the most common. I've not seen where that gives you any protection. At the same time, the body temperature is more of a response to our immune system fighting off the virus. And fever develops because of release of all kinds of inflammatory agents that bring up our temperature. And oftentimes that is not helpful. And we believe that the reason why the 1918 flu was so lethal is that it caused the same kind of cytokine storm that this particular agent is causing. And you're essentially, your body is overreacting to the infection, and you're essentially drowning in your own secretions in the lung. So that's why a lot of these agents like chloroquine, like Actemra, the monoclonal antibody, these are designed as anti-inflammatories. These are immune modulators. They're trying to stop your body from overreacting because your body is your worst enemy with at least these particular agents.
Thank you. WB to you.
So I wanted to just end this thing by talking about some of the negative impacts of our mitigation efforts. You know, the core of our lives, our normal social support networks, even the fabric of society is essentially being put aside to lessen the burden of our healthcare system, to try to keep us from having, allowing us to have enough ventilators and beds. But we're also seeing, with this mitigation effort, rises in domestic violence and child abuse. People are not getting their wellness medical checks or routine care for chronic disease, dental, eye care. Education is lacking because there's no school. And so all the determinants of health are essentially like healthy lifestyles, education, housing, income, employment, primary health care. All these things are being cast aside, and I'm afraid that they may wash up later as another epidemic or pandemic of ill physical and mental health. So I do think that it's very important for us to figure out a game plan to get us back to some normalcy. For me personally, it's a little disturbing to see children looking to the government leaders to advise them if it's safe to touch their parents or their grandparents. So I think that I bring this up because I think it's important for us to try to remain, to have some resiliency, to try to maintain our focus by keeping a schedule, by having a buddy that we can, you know, talk about our personal worries and maybe our hobbies. We need to have something to look forward to, maybe a vacation after COVID pandemic. And we just need to be able to try to maintain a sense of perspective and sometimes just writing down three good things that went well that day at the end of the day is the way to do it, because even in our worst days, there's always a few bright spots. And I'll kind of stop my presentation there and take any more questions.
KC3PDP.
W2LNX, I didn't get the first one. It's KA3IXO.
KC3PDP.
KC3PDP, KA3IXO.
Thanks, Doc, for your presentation. It's been really very informative and very interesting. I had a couple of comments that I was wondering if you could speak to, and I agree that trying to keep a positive attitude is helpful, but you know, this is, we're in uncharted territory in terms of our lifetime, 1918, you know, long time ago. It's hard to sort out what is reliable information from what is nonsense, and there's a lot of both out there. It's like trying to take a sip from a fire hose. So that's thing one. If you have any guidance for helping us to sort that out. In fact, my sister-in-law has recovered from COVID-19 in D.C., and she is reading that the chloroquine drugs aren't of any help. Your experience says otherwise. There are plenty of reports both ways. So that's one example. Pause for more.
The other thing, you hit on a very important point, is that, you know, our grandparents or great-grandparents were different. They lived with death almost every day. That was a natural part of their life. Either Billy didn't come back the next school semester because he died of tuberculosis or pneumonia, or they saw their grandfather die in their house because they that's the way families were back then. So death was always a part of our life. Nowadays, we don't have that. We've been spoiled by having all of this great health care and quality of life, and we live our lives with the philosophy of expecting zero casualties in everything we do and everything that other people do for us. And I think that's unrealistic, but it, in a pandemic like this, it creates so much anxiety and angst.
Yeah, I mean that's a great point. Of course, we are the people that we are living in modern times, and you know, I suppose we all have to readjust our frame and get some perspective. My second question for you was: do you have any sense of what, how close we are to being able to roll out the scale of testing, contact tracing, and that sort of thing, because I'm assuming that that's what will be required in order for us to go back to some kind of normal, a la what they have done in South Korea. And also, do you put any credence in that Imperial College of London study that talked about sort of having waves of restrictions imposed and lifted as the case counts in the hospitals went up? And I'll sit back and take my answer, KC3 PDB. Thank you.
KC3 ABB, KA3IXO. I think those are great, more philosophical questions than anything, but at the same time, I think that I would tend to recommend that people try to get their information from the CDC. World Health Organization is very good also with their information, and at least with respect to how to prevent getting the disease. I do think that the media is a problem with respect to giving so many different viewpoints that it's confusing for the American people or anyone to try to figure out what is right and what is wrong, and what should they do in this particular setting. Can you sort of explain your question a little bit better to me about where you're going with it?
I guess the thing I really wanted to hear you talk about is how close do you think we are to being able to implement the kinds of measures that will be necessary for us to kind of get back to some semblance of normal life. You know, in South Korea, it takes the form of contact tracing and extensive testing. I mean, you know, we've been hearing for months now that the testing is widespread and anybody who wants to get it can, but the reality on the ground seems otherwise. Do you have any sense of how close we are to having that be actually a reality, that people who are showing symptoms can get tested to confirm whether they need to quarantine or not? Over.
Okay, 3X. So now I understand where you're coming. Okay, so think of our society with all of our civil liberties that we have. If you wanted to flatten the curve, and maybe China has artificially flattened that curve too much, but they have the ability in their society to mandate and make people do what they want to do. South Korea is very tech-savvy, and the population there doesn't mind being monitored where they are at any time, whether they're at home or at work or out on the streets, and this is how they try to control the spread of disease, by identifying people who are infected and making sure that they are staying in place, and if they don't, they will arrest them or fine them or whatever. So I think that there's only a certain amount of things that the American people will, I think, stand for from the government. At the same time, to answer your question about what would it take to get back to normalcy, I think most of the medical experts are saying we got to have an immunological test, which are coming out, and probably in the next month we'll have quite a bit of it. to be able to identify people who clearly had the infection, are immune, and can go back to work. It will also identify people who are still susceptible and need to still follow the mitigation, some of the mitigation actions. But I think that it's going to take either the development of a prophylaxis or a test that will alleviate people's fear that they're not going to get the disease because they already have the disease and had it and they're immune to it and they can feel comfortable. And frankly, a lot of the companies, international companies, are trying to develop a pool of people who are immune, because those are going to be the go-to people that they're going to use to go to remote areas because they don't have to worry about them getting sick. But for the general population, it's one thing to have Zika virus go through the Western Hemisphere in a year and infect 95% of all the countries that it hit. You're going to have herd immunity and the virus disappears and you don't hear anything more about Zika. But this particular virus is going to go slowly, and it may be recurring year after year. We just don't know at this point, and I think we need to have a vaccine. So unfortunately, I know everybody wants to feel secure in being able to go back to activities, but I think they can't shake hands anymore. They're going to have to maintain social distancing. There's probably going to be more plexiglass in office settings and barriers to kind of keep people away from each other. And I think that's just going to be the reality until we have a vaccine.
3BIS, Paul.
KA3IXO. Paul, you were breaking up quite a bit, but I one of the things I got was that one of the doctors that knew was using doxycycline instead of hydroxychloroquine. And doxycycline is anti-inflammatory a very weak anti-inflammatory that rheumatologists sometimes will use to allow sparing of more powerful agents like steroids. But it's not actually, I've not seen any literature that it's actually having trials being done on it. The doxycycline is also used as an anti-malarial, and frankly, in my travel clinic, I haven't been able to get chloroquine for 3 years because the factory that made it was on an island that got knocked over by a hurricane. And so I've been using hydroxychloroquine for all my malaria patients who were going to Central America. So I don't know anything about the doxycycline other than it has mild anti-inflammatory effects, but I've not seen any notices that they have major trials with it. I didn't get your second question because you're breaking up. Against the COVID virus. I don't think that it has the immune modulating effect to the degree that chloroquine has, but chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine is a lot more dangerous in elderly people because they have older hearts and they tend to be more at risk of prolonging that QT interval that causes them to have the torsades that is a lethal rhythm and usually would kill them. And so we have to be very careful about hydroxychloroquine in the elderly. But I do think that in other populations, younger populations, it may be an effective treatment as well as maybe even a prophylactic agent.
Are there any other questions? 3IXO. W2LNX, David. K3IXO. Well, David, the two good questions. The controversy with ibuprofen is that they believe that it actually increases the number of the angiotensin receptors in the lung, and that may make people more susceptible for the virus to attack the lung and to have a more severe lung problem. However, other studies have not shown that that's been the case. And the same has been true with people who take Losartan for blood pressure. If you take it long enough, you might get more receptors in response to all the blocking that's occurring by the Losartan or these angiotensin receptor blockers. And that also has not been proven to be found to be true. So there's a lot of things that we're still learning about it. With respect to type of chlorine that is used in swimming pools, that is a very high concentration chlorine, and you have to use so little of it to make a hypochlorite solution, but you could do that. I'll just say one caveat is that a lot of people know that chloroquine is also used in fish tanks as a fish tank cleaner. And there's already been a few deaths and overdoses because people took that chloroquine and tried to make their own chloroquine out of it, but it's at too high of a concentration, and again, it's very cardiotoxic at very super high concentration. So, be careful when you're trying to use these particular agents. Certainly read the label. Were you able to get that, David? KA3IXO. This is KA3IXO. Are there any other questions?
K3CSX.
K3CSX. Fred. KA3IXO.
Thanks, Dr. Sorry. This has all been very fascinating, and I think it's like an opportunity that we are so lucky that we had that probably the general population isn't getting. The question I had was, I don't know that they're doing some investigation with convalescent plasma, and I was kind of curious. I don't know what the immunoglobulin component or whatever it is that they're using for that, because I always thought that the immunoglobulins were good for passive immunity for someone who is at risk of something like tetanus or rabies, and I don't know if that was what they were considering for giving it for close contact of someone who's been infected with COVID-19, or if there's actually something else in it that they're looking at it as a actual cure-type treatment, K3CSX.
Well, that's a good question, Fred. We've used convalescent sera for a century. Usually, people who have survived the disease, we've taken their blood and given it to other people, and it's hit or miss, but in I'd say 50% of the time, people that are having an overwhelming infection and they just, for some reason, can't get ahead of the infection, if you give other people's immunoglobulin that they produced as a result of that infection, you can help them beat the tide and get over the hump. Most of the immunoglobulin that we give for travelers or for rabies, for hepatitis B, those are actually pooled sera that we're collecting sera from people who have had these diseases and have high levels of IgG, the same IgG that we're looking for in those immunological tests. But these, since they've had recent infections, the amount of IgG, protective antibody that they have developed, is very specific against that infection. So we mainly try to tie the use of convalescent sera to someone who had the same disease, and then give it to someone who is not doing well with it. I can tell you that it doesn't work 100% of the time, but it's commonly used in severe infection.
Okay, so it's not actually a direct effect against the virus as much physician helping the patient's own system work against or try to fight it off itself. Is that correct?
It's not actually helping. It's not having an effect on the individual's immune system. It's actually giving a supplementing immune globulin that the patient isn't producing enough of. And each one of these antibodies will tag on to the virus and clear it from the bloodstream, clear it from the lungs. And so the more immunoglobulin you have, the more you can essentially try to clear the infection. And so oftentimes that's all the really sick individual needs in order to get an upper hand on the infection.
Okay, thank you very much for the explanation, K3CSX.
KC3CSX, Gus.
K3CSX, this is K3IXO. This is KA3IXO. Are there any other questions that I can at least try to answer?
KC3CHJ.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the full call sign, but please give me your question.
My question is kind of a unique one. I was wondering just on your opinion, a personal CPAP machine, is there any chance of aerosolizing the virus when using a personal CPAP? My concern is I'm a queer fireman for a living, and we have a common bunk room, and a number of individuals use CPAP. You know, and these are the folks that are running COVID patients during the day. And I just wondered if someone was asymptomatic, would you have any concern being in that small environment of still using a CPAP machine?
If you were infected, the CPAP machine may in some way promote some local aerosolization, but I'm not sure that you'd be coughing so much. I'm not sure you could actually use the CPAP if you had this disease. The biggest concern that we have in the general population of aerosolization is with vaping. Vaping seems to have these huge clouds, and this is essentially aerosolization. So if you have a young person who has a disease and he's vaping, he could actually maybe efficiently spread the disease a little further.
Wow, that's interesting, something I hadn't thought of. Thank you for your opinion on that.
This is KA3IXO. Been some very interesting questions, and certainly I think that this is a very dynamic process. Most epidemics are. I spent most of my career in the military dealing as an epidemiologist with epidemics, and I think that it's the uncertainty that creates all the anxiety. And I think that I would tend to, I think we have a good handle on this particular virus. We just need to gin up our tests and wait for the results of our antiviral trials. And I think that once the medical establishment, both here and in Europe and other countries, can show what works and what doesn't work, I think the American people will feel a sigh of relief.
PSR?
PSR, K3IXO.
Yeah, Mike, maybe I can be the last question for the evening. I'm not certain. But for someone who has an immune system that's been compromised from chemotherapy at some point in his life and is now undergoing monthly IVIG infusions, would that improve chances of not getting the COVID virus or at least being able to fight it off? Not exactly certain. And the question number two of the last question is, what is the relationship between the chloroquine and the effect on the heart in terms of creating that, I guess, irregular heartbeat that you were talking about? I meant to look that up earlier and forgot. Can you provide a comment on that as well? N3ESR back to Dr. Mike.
N3SR, this is K3IXO. I think that if anyone who's been received chemotherapy has an altered immune system, and whether they're getting IVIG or it's more the history of having had a bone marrow transplant or chemotherapy that makes your immune system not 100%, even though you're not having infections every day or that type of situation, you wouldn't mount as good a response against this particular serious virus infection. With respect to chloroquine, it prolongs the QT interval that, and by prolonging the refractory period of the heart, it allows other impulses to sneak in and cause lethal rhythms. The typical lethal rhythm is called torsades, which is a slow V-tach, and that is what kills a person because the ventricular tachycardia, it doesn't result in any effective blood pressure, and essentially your heart's not effectively pumping. So it's a very immediate type of death, and it requires resuscitation. If you have a elderly heart that's been damaged by previous heart attacks or has been weakened by heart failure, you're not likely to survive or recover from that type of rhythm disturbance. So it's very we will do an EKG before we even think of giving people hydroxychloroquine, even for malaria prophylaxis. A Brazilian study, a very small study, about 80, just terminated prematurely because they had a number of deaths due to this rhythm disturbance. So none of these are panacea. There's no free lunch in any of these tests. And like I say, a lot of these drugs that are being tested are based on only the thinnest of threads of in vitro evidence, animal models, and biological plausibility, and we need to go with caution. I know there are people that say, you know, the government's going too slow, the doctors are going too slow, we need something right away, but we have to make sure that we're not hurting people in the process. And hopefully that is addressing your questions. And then I'll go back to Alex, W3JG, and see if there's anything else she would like me to comment on.
Well, Dr. Sari, K3IXO, what an amazing presentation. I just have one last question. So we're now hearing talk about things starting to open up and some states opening up even before May. And while some states, particularly New York, are still having a very difficult time. So in your expert opinion, how will that work? What will they have to do, and how do you think that's going to work? And I think more specifically, I'd like to know how soon we can get back to a normal life. You know, something that, well, maybe we can never go back to what we were, but something where we can get out again and see our kids again and go shopping again, all those things. So this is W3JAG, back to Dr. Sari, KA3IXO.
All right, Alex. Gosh, the $64,000 question at the end. Okay. So I think that, let me go back to the models. The models always assumed that that the United States population was going to continue this mitigation process for 4 months. And again, their numbers were three times what we're seeing now. So, we're doing a good job in keeping and flattening the curve. And this disease has not hit some cities, and others, it's devastated. So I think that in the cities that it's devastated, we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. We're seeing the deaths and the cases that get hospitalized, the ones that are sick enough that they get their test. But that's the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole bunch of other asymptomatic cases that are probably in New York City, and that's their herd immunity, and that's what's going to protect them when they start to open up for business again. And I do think that, unfortunately, it was a very high price to pay for that herd immunity, and obviously we would like to achieve that artificially through a vaccine. But at the same time, I do think that contrary to what England is seeing, where there seems to be a lot of young people also equally suffering from this disease and requiring ICU care, we're not seeing that in the U.S. as much. The young people, especially below the age of 25, and I'd say most of the people below 50, are not really having significant infections with this. So they're the ones who are probably spreading the disease. And so those are the people that I would want to keep away from, the high-risk people, the nursing homes, people that are who are obviously identified as high risk. And unfortunately, I don't think there's a good solution for high risk individuals. I think they're just going to have to hunker down until there's a prophylaxis that we can give them, or an antiviral. The antivirals that we're looking at, like I say, is it may be time dependent. If I give Tamiflu 6 hours after you develop the flu, your flu has been reduced by 4 days. If I delay giving you that Tamiflu by 2 days, it doesn't work at all. So right now we're trying to do studies, not just on the people on ventilators. We're trying to do these studies on healthy people who have the disease but aren't very sick, to see whether or not we can actually use that to give people a little bit of a comfort level that, yeah, I'm going out, I'm going to resume my life, and if I happen to get it, I have a medicine that I can go to. But I'd say that that's all that we can really hope for at this time. I do think that the mitigation, how we live our lives now, big concerts, handshaking, these are things that probably are going to have to be put on hold until we get a vaccine. So I think that's the best answer I can give you, Alex, K3IXO.
Well, thanks a lot, Dr. Sari. What you've given us is a lot of hope. I'm going to give one last chance for anybody if they have questions while we have the good doctor here. We don't get an opportunity like this. This is very rare. Like Fred, KC3SX said, we're very lucky to have Dr. Sari with us here tonight. So if there are any more questions, I'll give you one last chance. I know we're imposing on the doctor's good time. But come now, please, if you have another question.
WA3UHC, question.
I missed your call sign, but please go ahead. This is K3IXO.
Is it safe to assume that a recent lung PE would mean that that person is compromised?
No, a prolonged QT interval just means that they have a predisposition to get a fatal arrhythmia if they take drugs that are going to prolong it even more, but it has nothing to do with immunity. It just is a rhythm risk that that individual has, and it usually is found actually in women over the age of 80, and so it's not something we tend to see very often in the general public.
Thank you. I meant clots in the lung.
Oh, I'm sorry. Misunderstood. So pulmonary, if you've had a pulmonary embolism, if the pulmonary embolism was what we call mild, in other words, the clot broke up and sort of dissipated and your lung function returned, your lungs are as good as they were in the beginning. However, if you had a massive pulmonary embolism, you could have lost half your perfusion to part of your lung, and that would put you at increased risk from a
pneumonia like COVID-19.
I think someone was trying to get through the W3JAG. Okay, well, Dr. Sari, I think we've had a wonderful, very informative, very inspirational presentation. Would you like to say a last couple of words? I'd really like to, I mean, as much as you are knowledgeable, you are also really tuned into the needs of people on a personal level, on a social level. And so is there any last thing you'd like to tell us? Because you've made me feel more hopeful about what's going on. So this is W3JAG. Back to Kilo Alpha 3, India X-ray, Oscar, Dr. Sari.
Well, Alex, thank you for the kind words, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to the guys and gals who I've known for 10-plus years. And I think that, getting the word out is, I think, half the battle. And I think one of the gentlemen was correct in saying that the messages are oftentimes jumbled up and don't know what to believe and what not to believe. But I would certainly try to rely on the CDC because they are really correct. And, I think that there's a lot of misinformation, propaganda, all kinds of things that we're hearing. But if people have a question, I have found that the CDC is always given a good reference or a good answer to the question. So I wish everybody stay safe and keep on the air. This is KA3IXO signing off.
Well, thank you so much, KA3IXO, for an amazing evening. Lots of great information from the expert. We are very lucky to have you here with us tonight. And more importantly, you've been very inspirational, gave us a lot of hope beyond the current challenge. So anyway, thank you so much. And as we always end our meetings, I will take a motion to adjourn.